Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week in June. I don't know how we got to the first week in June so fast, but here we are. Today, Michael Dawson will be here to describe his work with water quality for the Jefferson County Environmental Health Department. But first, we will hear our mystery sound. This one should be familiar. All kinds of interesting observations came in this week. The first one is one that I noticed while hiking, which is spiders hatching. Some of you may already be turning off the radio, I hope not, but spiders from an egg sac, when they hatch, they are absolutely tiny. They hatch either from living over the winter or they are laid here in the early spring. The average female spider's egg sac holds about 100 eggs, but many of them have a lot more than this. And what generally happens is that you will hear them or see them emerging. They're very quiet, but you can see them wiggling. And the newly hatched spider is as small as a typed letter O, I would say 10-point type. And it's absolutely engaging. So you have to imagine a small letter O with eight legs. They have to leave immediately when they're hatched to get food. And by pure instinct, they turn around and lift their spinnerets. These are little web producers at the back of their bodies. They produce one web thread and they float off, either to survive and grow or to be caught by a chickadee or one of the many other hungry creatures around here.
Ocean spray. This common shrub has fluffy, cream-colored blooms that dangle and move in wind. The name ocean spray perfectly suits the flowering appearance. It usually blooms in late June, but nearly is a month early this year. Ocean spray shows up along road edges and can be an early arrival after fire or clear cutting or building. Most of the year it blends into other plants and is often unnoticed.
Caspian terns. We had a couple of people talk to us about having seen Caspian terns. Spring brings them. They are noticed, certainly, by their size. This is a large seabird, the biggest of the world's terns. It has a bright red-orange beak, absolutely crayon bright, a black-capped head, and a shining white body. The head feathers look slicked back as if by hair gel. And if you think that sounds odd, find a picture of one, because that's exactly the way they look. And if you think you've noticed a gull, dive straight down into the water when fishing. You have really seen the Caspian tern. They come down in an absolute arrow, straight down. The impact when the Caspian tern hits a fish must be deadly, but it guarantees food. Or maybe instant sushi. I keep thinking that the fish must just sort of be in pieces. The Caspian tern flies with its beak pointed down when fishing, poised for this very quick descent, and this is not something that the gulls will do. Caspian terns spend the winter in Central America and the Caribbean islands, including Cuba. They return north to breed, seeking places with ample fish and low-lying terrain. One of the largest breeding colonies in the world is at the mouth of the Columbia River, and much of it is on a little island called East Sand Island, which is not accessible by people. They scrape nests on sand, they pad them with twigs and other seaborne litter, and then they hunch down and raise their young, usually three or four at a time. And this spring, up to 6,000 pairs have been counted so far at this nesting area in Oregon. After late July, the terns begin their migration south for winter, probably in search of mojitos.
Local sea lions showed various resting poses recently. Sarah Fairbank wrote, "We saw two sea lions sleeping in kelp off Fort Casey in very vertical positions, noses above the water looking like big kelp bulbs." Sea lions can gather in large colonies sleeping like this, a grouping named rafting. Another observer noticed a sea lion with its head out and one flipper lifted out of the water. This odd behavior sometimes confuses watchers into thinking the animal is injured. It's a way for the sea lion to regulate its body temperature, carrying warmth via veins down into its core, or cooling itself if needed. This is called sailing, but the flipper doesn't really resemble any sailboat known. A website with more information about pinnipeds has the charming address www.blubberblog.org. There's a good photo of a sea lion sailing.
I'm glad to introduce Michael Dawson today. He's the water quality manager at Jefferson County Environmental Health. If you look at a map, the region we live in is absolutely defined by water. Ocean, lakes, rivers. I can't imagine the water disappearing, and it's not going to. The water quality work that Mike does helps all of us experience our water safely. So hi and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. Just a little personal thing. How did you become interested in studying water in the wild?
Well, I suppose it goes back to growing up in rural New Hampshire and being an only child and having a nice big marsh in the backyard that I used to love to go and try and catch frogs and things like that.
Yeah. And there's so much to observe.
So just spending a lot of time outdoors, I think, as a kid is, it's been a big influence on a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And certainly on your life, since you're doing what you're doing now, getting outside and studying the water. I read something, I think, yesterday that said, people who are contented often wind up doing what they enjoyed when they were 10. So that could be the truth.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to be happy, is to follow what your interests are as a kid.
We sure hope so, right. Well, Jefferson County is so big, it covers a huge amount of area, all the way out to the Pacific. So I had wondered how, since you're doing sampling and studying water quality, how do you select where your work will concentrate?
Yeah, well, in Jefferson County, part of that selection was done a while back by the Board of County Commissioners in forming a clean water district, which covers the eastern part of Jefferson County, and that helps to fund our water quality program. So a decision was made, the population centers and a lot of the heavily used areas are in the eastern part of the county. So that's where we focus our work on right now. And there's still an awful lot of water resources just in this half of the county. I think there's 200 miles of marine shoreline. And
starting from the edge of the county
of
and working your way around, around the thumb of the Quimper Peninsula and down
from
toward
Hood
Brennan.
Canal, all the way up. We've got the islands, Maristone Island, Indian Island.
Oh, right.
Protection Island, and it ends up being a lot of shoreline.
And you mentioned that you had walked most of it.
Yeah, at one time or another, we walk the whole shoreline to take water samples and make sure the water is clean. And so we've covered now, I won't say every last mile, but about 90% of it. So
It's awfully crooked, too, when you look at the maps.
Yeah, some of it is difficult to access. We can only get to some of it by boat.
Mm-hmm. And I should think that a portion of your sampling is done by boat.
A little bit, yeah. Most of it is done walking. We get to a lot of stream sites just off of roads and things like that.
But But you're looking for a site that hasn't got artificial pollution, so you don't end up picking up something that's not actually in the water.
Well, we want a mix, yeah. We want some sites where we think they can be sort of our control areas where we have fairly pristine conditions. And we have, of course, Olympic National Park and the National Forest, all these protected areas. So we have a lot of headwaters of streams and rivers that are in quite good shape.
I didn't ask you this before, but how many people are there who help you with the sampling and studying?
Well, we have about five people. Not all of them are full-time. We have a number of people who do different things in the department. We're a small department, so we all have to kind of wear many hats and do different things.
Well, one of the hats that you're wearing right now is studying paralytic shellfish poisoning in the Quilcene Daybob area. I've just read about it in the news, so maybe you can tell me a little more about it.
Yeah, it's kind of unusual because we have a bloom of harmful algae that's producing toxins in a place where in the past we never used to get these kind of toxins. Saxitoxin, which is produced by dinoflagellate, is kind of a deadly toxin, and it can produce something called paralytic shellfish poisoning, and that's quite a dangerous condition We've had people get sick in this county in the past. Luckily, so far this year, no reports of illness due to paralytic shellfish poisoning. But
well, getting the sampling done and informing people about it is a big part of your job then. You don't want to hear about people getting sick.
Exactly, yeah. So we help collect samples to monitor this stuff, and we post signs, and we do press releases. We had a meeting down in Quilcene 2 weeks ago, just trying to get the word out. And people are used to perhaps collecting shellfish in the same areas over the years, and yet what we're finding right now is that these kind of harmful algae blooms are happening more frequently, more severely. Sometimes they're happening in new areas where we've never seen them before. So,
which is the case with the one that's happening down toward Daybob then, right?
Right.
Or you said it started in fall 2014?
Yeah, starting last September, we got some very high toxin levels, which caused a closure. That went on through the fall, and then the toxin levels went down through the winter. But with this microorganism, they form a cyst, which then overwinters in the sediment on the bottom of the bay.
Then have a way of taking care of themselves until it's time to come out again.
Right. And they kind
Is this cyst big enough to see? I got to wondering about that.
It's microscopic.
It's microscopic, right.
Yeah. So studies were done in the winter, and they found that there were quite a few cysts in Quilcene and Daybob sediments. So that just kind of meant that there were organisms around that could then take advantage of the warm spring weather. Mm-hmm. This bloom now is a really early bloom, this current one that we've got. It's just not something that we've seen before, but all the conditions were right. So the little critters have taken off.
For those of you who hadn't recognized this at this point, what Mike is dealing with in water is all microscopic. You are going to get information about it, but unless you have a microscope, you're not going to be looking down into the water and finding an organism for paralytic shellfish poisoning floating by, so you can't really see them.
Yeah, and there's sort of an unfortunate misnomer if you think of the term red tide, which
sure,
a lot of us are familiar with as talking about these sorts of events. The species that actually bloom and cause toxins don't actually make a red-colored bloom in the water. But there are other species that you can see. We sometimes do see some colored blooms in the water, but those species actually aren't the ones usually causing the problems.
Aha. Uh-huh. Which means that information is what is the heart of everything you do then.
Yeah, so you can't really tell unless, you know, a laboratory has tested the shellfish. And so luckily in this state, we have the Washington State Department of Health has quite a big testing program for all of Puget Sound and the outer coast beaches. And they're testing at every low tide. Lots of different organizations are out there helping to collect the samples, including us. And you don't know until you send the sample in and get the results back. It takes just 24 hours.
But that means that in some places, the testing is almost daily. I had wondered about that because you've got to start someplace, but how do you keep rhythm going so that you can keep people informed as things change?
Yeah, basically every good daytime low tide, there's some samples being taken, but they're being taken from different water bodies.
Ah.
Most water bodies get sampled about once every 2 weeks.
Okay. And we haven't really looked at this in any kind of detail, but something with a scary name like paralytic shellfish poisoning, how does it actually affect people?
That's one of the most scary ones, and it's because if you eat shellfish that has this toxin, the toxin doesn't affect the shellfish. It doesn't kill them.
That's really amazing.
You know?
Why aren't they paralyzed?
Yeah,
they look fine, right?
You know, they're filter feeders, so they're picking up these organisms and filtering them and eating them. And then the toxins that are in these organisms get incorporated into their bodies, and they build up and build up. Don't hurt the shellfish, but then for humans, it's another story. If you eat that, the saxitoxin can basically paralyze you, and what it does, one of the first things that it does is cause some of your nerves to not work anymore. You feel this tingling or numbness sometimes in your extremities, and then it can very quickly stop your breathing. And that's where you need to be transported to a hospital, and hopefully they can they can
do
catch
something
you quick
about
enough.
It. Yeah. You mentioned briefly the first time this had been reported a long time ago, that it isn't a new organism.
Yeah, well, interestingly, I mean, the first recorded case of paralytic shellfish poisoning was right in this neck of the woods. It was in 1793 on Vancouver, Captain Vancouver's first voyage to the Northwest. Some of his sailors took the rowboat ashore to get some fresh shellfish and cooked them and ate them and promptly got very sick. One of them died. So that was a very early case. Now we know from the symptoms that were recorded at the time what that was from.
It's amazing what careful records people kept on ships at that point. I'm always thinking, gosh, it's stormy and I'm running out of ink. Do I really want to write this down? Or the doctor in the case must have been really puzzled not knowing what was affecting these people.
Yeah, probably.
And so many things that can happen on a voyage like that. So I wanted to follow up a little bit with something you touched on, but we haven't really talked as much about it, which is, what are the circumstances affecting how some of these blooms can happen? You mentioned spring, which would require temperature factors, but there are other things affecting the water. I know everybody wants to know, well, if we knew what caused it, then we'd be able to fix it, but that's not the state.
Yeah, and there are factors, though, that we know that will help make a bloom happen, and one of the biggest things is nutrients. You have to have some nutrients for the organisms to be able to multiply so fast. And
is that nutrient primarily nitrogen?
In the ocean, it's primarily nitrogen, although phosphorus is another important one. And
the shellfish are saltwater.
Yeah.
They're in saltwater, so right. You have some of that ocean characteristic, right?
Yeah. There can be some natural sources of nitrogen, and then some sources can be added to by human activities, so things like lawn fertilizers or a septic system that isn't totally working right and adding some nutrients, extra nutrient loads to the water.
This is going to sound political. It almost makes me wonder what's happening in the vicinity of Victoria, British Columbia, but we don't want to think about it.
Yeah, that's certainly a nutrient load there,
it
too.
It certainly is, right. So you have nutrients, you have temperature. Would there be any effect from the dry, snowless winter that we've had? I know that sounds strange, but
yeah, well, we think there probably could be, because normally in the spring we get a lot of very cold fresh water coming down off of the mountains from the snow melting, and that cold fresh water sits as kind of like a lens on top of the marine water for a while. That really changes the way that both the water circulates and the way that organisms have access to different nutrients and
so they
light.
Might. This is a sort of a naive guess, but they might then, under that circumstance, with cool fresh water as a lens, not multiply as fast as they would if they were completely open to air.
Yeah, it's possible. And there's a number of things that also happen. Often in the spring, we get a lot of turbidity from erosion from the high river levels, and that prevents light from reaching deeper layers, which these are organisms that photosynthesize, so they need light. Mm-hmm. Each little area of Puget Sound acts a little differently. I don't know if anybody has added it all up. It's going to be interesting to see what happens this year, since the pattern looks like it's going to be fairly different.
For all of the organisms that live in or use water, which includes us, it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
I was wondering also about, just briefly, since this is certainly a crisis in the Quilcene Daybob area, you've had a lot of, I would say, information and somewhat confusion about what's going on at Anderson Lake. It was open for fishing, and then wham, it wasn't after about 10 days. So the first testing, it looked okay, and then there you were? Or?
Well, and that's actually kind of the typical pattern that we've been seeing there. We have usually a bloom that develops in Anderson Lake. This is different organisms we're talking
sure.
about now.
This is a cyanobacteria.
Cyanobacteria,
yeah.
A similar process: when the temperatures warm up and you have nutrients available, they start multiplying very fast. Anderson this year, we had a bloom that started when the lake opened for fishing, but it wasn't producing any toxins. And then what we do is we look at what the bloom looks like, but we take toxin samples that are analyzed by King County Environmental Labs in Seattle.
Okay.
They're testing for the actual toxins that can affect you. Yeah, as soon as the toxin levels went above the recreational guidelines, we recommended to state parks that they close.
Well, and it's a place where people need to keep their dogs from jumping into the lake also, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the toxin levels there often get high enough that they're going to be lethal to dogs and potentially humans. We have had two dogs die from drinking the water there
and
swimming in the water.
Some years ago, 8 years ago or something.
Six or seven.
It's getting harder and harder to subtract because the numbers are getting bigger on our years.
Yeah.
We are unfortunately running out of time, which I think I'd like to keep going for the next couple of days talking about this because it means so much to all of us that we have the beautiful waters around us that we have. And I'm extremely pleased that you have been able to come in and let us know more about how your water quality department works. We really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
We appreciate what's going on. And as you said, there's lots of other programs. We may get a chance to talk about this again sometime. I sure hope so.
I hope so too.
Thanks to Mike Dawson, Manager for Water Quality with the Environmental Health Department in Jefferson County. This has been terrific. Thank you. Our mystery sound. If you are a regular listener, well, aren't you all regular listeners? You've heard this bird sound hundreds of times when it introduces the show. This is the common raven, or the northern raven. I prefer to call it the northern raven because this bird is not common at all. They intrigue humans with their intelligence, their woods wisdom, and their striking presence when calling or flying. They are able to fly upside down. One raven was noted flying upside down for a half a mile, and frequently they do aerial somersaults. They have been observed dropping a small stick and swooping to catch it. This seems to be either a game or a way of tuning up their muscles. One writer described their play. In captivity, ravens can learn to talk better than some parrots. They also mimic other noises like car engines, toilets flushing, and other animal and bird calls. Ravens have been known to imitate wolves or foxes to attract them to a carcass that the raven isn't capable of breaking open. When the wolf or fox is done eating, the raven gets the leftovers. Ravens are omnivorous. They hunt for either live or expired food. They live generally in pairs and are monogamous, as far as anyone can tell. Bigger groups might be found at large food sources like animal carcasses or garbage dumps. They can live 17 years in the wild or up to 40 years in captivity. I'm not sure why someone would want to keep a raven in captivity when they're so happy outside, but think of the fact that there are ravens at the Tower of London and that it is said that if the ravens are gone, London will cease to exist, or at least the tower will cease to exist. These ravens have fascinated humans from the very earliest of eras. And for lots more about ravens, look up Bernd Heinrich's book, Mind of the Raven. And some events coming up, all of them getting you outdoors. Thursday, June 4th, is a Jefferson Land Trust work party for summer stewardship at Donovan Preserve in Quilcene. They're doing these work parties in various places every 2 weeks, which is a good way to help the environment and get out and see something. Saturday, June 6th, there will be a program called Birds Out of the Nest at the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, the Dungeness location, from 10 a.m. to noon. Birds are now hatching and fledging, and this is to learn how they act in this most vulnerable stage of their life. And finally, Saturday, June 6th, is a very low tide. There will be a low tide walk starting at noon at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. natural history exhibit. The low tide walk will help every citizen be a scientist, explore the ebbs and flows of the marine coastal environment on this low tide walk, and you can also learn more about oceanography from them. Next week, you will find that Nature Now is presenting a program called Digging for Dinner. This is digging for clams, not carrots. And that's it for this week's episode of Nature Now. Thanks for help from engineer Charlie Fleischman. We have enjoyed bringing you this authentic, eclectic, and local news from the wonderful world of nature. This program repeats at 5 o'clock on Thursdays and 11:30 on Saturdays. Podcasts of recent shows are at kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Today's closing music is We Are Water, performed by the cast of the television series Nashville. I hear it talking to me.